whatever forms of ID I would need.
The day after getting my learner's permit, I found a studio apartment in a complex called the Players Club, which was suitable but nowhere near as appealing as my previous place. It was small but cozy. I didn't have the luxury of being picky. The rent was $510 a month, meaning I had 6 months before my money would run out. Provided I didn't have too much trouble finding a job, it was an acceptable risk. Around the same time, the newspapers were carrying news stories about hacker Kevin Polson. He had been transferred from custody in Northern California and was being held in a place all too familiar to me, the Metropolitan Detention Center in Los Angeles. He was being charged with hacking offenses and gathering national defense information, an espionage-related offense. I was determined to talk to him, an ambition in keeping with my lifelong penchant for scheming to accomplish the impossible. I liked nothing better than to set myself a challenge that I didn't think could be done, then see if I could do it. Visiting Polson was obviously out of the question. For me, the Metropolitan Detention Center was like the Hotel California in the old Eagles song. I could check out any time I wanted, but I could never leave. My conversations with him would have to be by phone, but inmates couldn't receive calls, and besides, all inmate calls are monitored or recorded. Given the charges Polson was facing, the prison staff had likely flagged him as high risk and were keeping him closely monitored. Still, I told myself, there's always a way. Each housing unit at the MDC had a public defender's phone, a telephone with what the phone companies call a direct connect service. When an inmate picked up the handset, he would be connected directly to the federal public defender's office. I knew these were the only phones available to prisoners that weren't subject to monitoring because of attorney-client privilege, but they were also programmed at the phone company's switch so that they couldn't be used for incoming calls, deny terminate in telco lingo, and couldn't connect to any numbers other than the main telephone number at the public defender's office. I'd crossed that bridge when I came to it. First, I needed to get the numbers. It took me only 20 minutes to social engineer Pacific Bell and learn the 10 direct connect service numbers working in the prison. Next, I called the Recent Change Memory Authorization Center, RCMAC. I said I was calling from Pacific Bell's business office and requested that deny terminate be immediately removed from those 10 numbers. The RCMAC clerk gladly complied. Then, taking a deep breath, I called the receiving and discharge office at the prison itself.
"This is Unit Manager Taylor at Terminal Island," I said, trying to sound like a bored, frustrated prison drone. Using the name of the Bureau of Prisons' main computer system along with Polson's inmate registration number, I went on. "Sentry is down here. Can you look up reg number 95596-012 for me?"
When the guy at the prison looked up Polson's number, I asked what housing unit he was in.
6 South, he said.
That narrowed it down, but I still didn't know which of the 10 phone numbers was located on 6 South. On my microcassette player, I recorded a minute or so of the ringing sound that you hear on the phone when you call someone. This would only work if an inmate picked up the phone to call his public defender during those 2 or 3 minutes when I was calling into the phone. I would have to try many, many times before someone picked up. Another of those times when it helped to be patient and doggedly determined. When I hit it just right, and an inmate picked up the receiver, I'd let him hear a few rings on my microcassette player. Then I'd stop the ringing and say, "Public Defender's Office, may I help you?" When the inmate asked for his lawyer, I'd say, "I'll see if he's available," then pretend to go off the line for a minute. I'd come back on, tell him his attorney wasn't in at the moment, and ask his name. Then, nonchalantly, as if I were taking down all the relevant information, I'd ask, "And what housing unit are you in?" Then I'd say, "Try calling back in an hour or two," so no one would notice that a lot of public defenders never seemed to get their messages. Each time an inmate did answer, I was able to identify another housing unit and take that number off my list. Jotting down the details on a notepad, I was slowly constructing a map of which phone numbers connected to which inmate housing units. At last, after several days of dialing phone numbers, I reached an inmate on 6th South.
I remembered the internal extension for 6 South from when I was in solitary confinement at MDC. Among the things I had done during that time to keep my mind active and preserve my sanity was to listen to announcements over the prison's PA system and store in my memory every phone extension I heard. If an announcement said, CO Douglas, call Unit Manager Chapman on 427, I'd make a mental note of the name and number. As I've said, I seem to have an uncanny memory for phone numbers. Even today, years later, I still know quite a few of the phone numbers at that prison, as well as maybe dozens, perhaps hundreds of numbers for friends, phone company offices, and others that I'll probably never have any use for again, but that were seared into my brain anyway. What I needed to do next seemed impossible. I had to find a way to call the prison itself and make arrangements for a phone call with Kevin Polson that would not be monitored. Here's how I went about it. I called the main number of the prison, identified myself as a unit manager at TI, Terminal Island Federal Prison, and asked for extension 366, the number to the 6 South Guard. The operator put me through. The guard answered,
6 South, AG.
I knew this guy from when I had been a prisoner there myself. He had gone out of his way to make my life miserable, but I had to keep my anger in check. I said, this is Marcus in R&D, meaning receiving and discharge. Do you have inmate Paulson there?
Yeah.
We have some personal property of his that we want to get out of here. I need to find out where he wants it shipped.
Paulson!
The guard screamed much louder than necessary. When Kevin came on the line, I said, Kevin, act like you're talking to someone in R&D. Yeah, he said in a completely flat tone. This is Kevin, I said. We had never met, but I knew him by reputation and figured he'd know about me the same way. And I figured he'd know there wasn't any other Kevin who could be calling him in prison. I told him, be at the public defender's phone at exactly 1 o'clock. Pick up the phone, but keep flashing the switch hook every 15 seconds until I connect. Since the ringer was turned all the way down, he wouldn't know the exact moment when I would be calling in. Now give me your home address so AG hears it. I told him I was shipping your property there. After all the trouble AG had caused me, it was sweet to have tricked him into getting Polson on the line. At exactly 1 o'clock, I called the public defender's phone in 6 South. Because Polson hadn't said much in the first call and I wasn't familiar with his voice, I wanted to be sure I was really talking to him when I called back, so I tested him. In C, give me a syntax for incrementing a variable. He easily gave the correct answer, and we chatted at leisure, free from any concerns about federal agents listening to our conversation. I was amused to think that, as I was evading the feds, I was also hacking into a prison to speak to an inmate charged with espionage. On January 27th, a lucky break provided Shimmy and his team with the first strand of the net they would weave in the hope of closing in on me. The well had an automated DiskHog program that would periodically send emails to users who were using a lot of disk space. One of these messages went to Bruce Cobol, who had a role in staging an annual public policy event called the Computers, Freedom, and Privacy Conference, CFP. The email message noted that the conference's account was taking up more than 150 megabytes on the well's servers. Cobol checked the account and discovered that none of the files belonged to CFP. Looking at files that contained emails, he saw that all were addressed to tsutomu@sdsc.com. That night, Cobol looked at his next day edition of the New York Times and saw a page one story in the business section by John Markoff. Under the headline, Taking a Computer Crime to Heart, the story included this. It was as if the thieves, to prove their prowess, had burglarized the locksmith, which was why Tsutomu Shimomura, the keeper of the keys in this case, was taking the break-in as a personal affront, and why he considers solving the crime a matter of honor. Mr. Shimomura, one of the country's most skilled computer security experts, was the person who prompted a government computer agency to issue a chilling warning on Monday. Unknown intruders, the agency warned, had used a sophisticated break-in technique to steal files from Mr. Shimomura's own well-guarded computer in his home near San Diego. The next day, Cobol phoned Markoff, who put him in touch with Shimmy. It didn't take long to confirm that most of the mysterious files stored in the CFP account were from the Christmas Day attack on Shimmy's computers.
This was his first big break. Now, he had a lead to follow. Around this same time, my cousin Mark Mitnick, whom I had become close to, was going to be vacationing at Hilton Head, South Carolina, with his father. Mark invited me to join them. Mark was running a company in Sacramento called AdWorks and had offered to help me get set up on the East Coast using the same business model. He provided businesses like major supermarkets with free cash register tape, which was printed on the back with ads. Mark earned his money by finding companies that would pay to have their ads on the back of the tape. I needed a steady income, and the idea of having my cousin Mark help me get started in my own business sounded very attractive, even though it wasn't computer-related. We met in Raleigh and drove through several cities on our way to Hilton Head so he could make a number of sales calls. He invited me along to teach me the business. I liked the idea of always being on the move because it would make me harder to find. I would have enjoyed our trip more if it hadn't been for an item that turned up during one of my routine online checks for any indication that the feds were getting closer to me. There were stories all over the media about a press release just issued by the U.S. Department of Justice. The title of one story was U.S. Hunts Master Computer Cracker. In part, it read, Washington, D.C., USA, 1995, January 26th. The U.S. Marshals Service is on the trail of a computer hacker who disappeared after being convicted of one electronic crime and charged with another. Authorities say they are trying to locate Kevin David Mitnick, 31, originally from Sepulveda, California. Deputy U.S. Marshal Kathleen Cunningham told NewsBytes the Marshals Service had a probation violation warrant for Mitnick since November 1992 and almost caught up with him in Seattle last October. Cunningham said Mitnick is a ham radio enthusiast and is believed to use a scanner to keep track of police in the area where he is hiding. Local police didn't use radio security, so as soon as his address was mentioned, he was out of there. He just left everything. Mitnick is considered an expert at gaining control of computers to monitor or use communication systems and knows how to manufacture false identities using computers. This hit me like a ton of bricks. I was surprised, shocked, and in near panic. The feds and the media had turned a supervised release violation into a global manhunt. I couldn't leave the country even if I'd wanted to. I suspected that the feds must have already asked Interpol to issue a red notice launching a global watch for me, and my only passport, which I had stashed away unused, was in the Mitnick name. When Mark and his dad returned to the hotel from playing golf, I showed them the news story. Both looked shocked. I was worried I had done the wrong thing in showing it to them, afraid they would tell me I had to leave because my presence could put them at risk. Fortunately, they never mentioned the subject, but my paranoia had been driven up a few notches. The heat was being turned up on finding me. Did the feds suspect I was the one who had hacked Shimmy? On January 29th, Super Bowl Sunday, the San Francisco 49ers were playing the San Diego Chargers. Mark and his dad were excited about watching the game, but I couldn't have cared less. I had a lot on my mind and just wanted to relax. Rather than going back to the room for some more online activities, I decided to take a walk on the beach to get a breath of fresh air. I decided to give John Littman a call. "I'm walking on the beach here and relaxing," I told him. "On the beach? Are you really on the beach?" "Yeah, I'll let you go. I'm sure you're getting ready to watch the game." Littman told me the game hadn't started yet. He asked, "What do the waves look like?" Why would he ask me such a stupid question? I wasn't going to tell him the surf conditions and give him a clue to my current location. I said, "I can't tell you, but you can listen to them," and held the cell phone up in the air. I asked if he'd heard about the U.S. Marshals UPI press release asking for the public's help in finding me. I complained that there was a lot of bullshit in the article, including the same old Markov myth that I had hacked NORAD. Littman asked if I'd read Markov's story of the previous day. When I said I hadn't, he read it to me over the phone, I suppose listening to gauge my reaction. I pointed out that the U.S. Marshal's plea for help had been published the day after Markov broke the story about Shimmy's Christmas Day attack. It didn't feel like a coincidence to me. It felt like part of a planned strategy to leverage the public's fears about cyberspace against me, I told him. Markov has been asking questions about you, Littman said, and he thinks he knows where you're hiding. I pressed him to tell me more, but he wouldn't budge. I changed tactics and asked him to take his own guess about where I might be.
Are you living somewhere in the Midwest?
Happily, he was way off. Yet it appeared that Markov had some information that was important to me, and I needed to think about finding out how much he knew. A few days later, it occurred to me that if the feds were trying that hard to track me down, they might have tapped my grandmother's phone in Las Vegas. That's what I would have done. Centel's line assignment group had information about every phone line in Las Vegas. I knew the number off the top of my head. Posing as a technician in the field, I asked one of the clerks to pull up my grandmother's telephone number on her computer. I asked her to read me the cabling information, and as I'd suspected, there was special equipment recently connected to her line. The clerk said the order had been placed a few days earlier by a Centel security agent named Sal Luca. I felt like turning the tables on Luca by tapping his line, but I knew it wouldn't yield any valuable information. My next thought was to feed my pursuers disinformation by calling my grandmother with some cock and bull story that I was in the Great White North, but I didn't want to put her under any more stress than she was already dealing with. While I was thinking over my next move, I had to continue building my new identity. On February 2nd, I had an appointment to take the driving test to upgrade my learner's permit to a driver's license under my G. Thomas Case identity. To do that, though, I would need to find a car that didn't have any connection to any of my past names. I hailed a cab. "Hey, you want to make an easy $100?" I asked the driver. He responded with a grin that revealed his missing teeth and answered with something that sounded like, "Tik, tikka," followed by, "Sure, okay." The foreign words turned out to be Hindi for more or less the same thing. Damn, I should have offered him 50 instead. We agreed that he would pick me up the next day, and he gave me his pager number. At the DMV the following day, when the examiner realized I was going to take the test in a cab, he tossed me a suspicious look. We got in, and I put down the flag, telling him, "I'm going to have to charge you for this ride." The expression on his face was priceless. When he saw I was laughing, he laughed, too, and we got off to a great start.
35. Game over.
By Tuesday, February 7th, a posse was being formed to catch me. Assistant U.S. Attorney Kent Walker now stepped into the case, meeting with Shimmy and his girlfriend, Julia Menapace, Shimmy's assistant, Andrew Gross, two FBI agents, and the Wells vice president and system administrator, as well as its attorney, John Mendez, who had some special clout in the room since he had previously been with the U.S. Attorney's office and had been Walker's boss. Walker was based in Northern California and had no previous connection to my case, and, according to the record, would be bending rules and crossing some lines to give Shimmy an extraordinary role through the following days. It was like some Wild West posse of old, where the U.S. Marshal deputized civilians to assist him in tracking down a wanted man. Apparently, Walker made a secret arrangement to provide Shimmy with confidential tap and trace information, as well as confidential information from the FBI files on me. Shimmy could intercept my communications without a warrant, under the pretense that he was not assisting the government, but rather working only for the internet service providers. The feds would never charge me with hacking Shimamura. I believe this was because they couldn't afford to expose their gross misconduct, which appeared to violate federal wiretapping statutes. It seems Shimmy appeared to be put in charge of the investigation as a de facto government agent. This was unprecedented. Perhaps the feds figured they would never find me without Shimmy's vigilante persistence. My conversation with Littman kept nagging at me. After talking to Markov, Littman thought he knew what part of the country I was in. It was time for me to get access to Markov's email and find out what he knew. Tracing the path was simple. All emails addressed to his NYT.com address were sent to Internex, a small internet service provider in Northern California. After probing the Internex Solaris server for a few minutes, I sighed with relief. The idiot administrating the system exported everyone's home directory using Sun's network file system to everyone on the internet. meaning I could remotely mount any user's home directory, that is, make the entire directory accessible to my local system. I uploaded our host's file to a user's directory, which I configured to trust any user connecting in from any host, meaning I was able to log into his or her account without needing a password. Once logged in, I was able to exploit another vulnerability to gain root access. It took a total of 10 minutes. I almost wanted to send the system admin a thank you letter for leaving the system wide open. Just that easily, I had access to Markov's emails. Unfortunately, he had set up his email client software to delete the messages after he retrieved them. Several messages had been left on the server, but they didn't contain any information related to me. I added a little configuration change so any new email sent to Markov would also be forwarded to another email address under my control. I was hoping to uncover his sources, people who might have told him where they thought I was. I was also eager to find out more about the extent of his involvement in my case. While I was doing this, I later learned Shimmy and his team were watching. They had been passively monitoring incoming network traffic at both the well and Netcom. It was a very easy thing to pull off because the internet service providers had given his team full access to their networks. After setting up surveillance at Netcom around February 7th, Shimmy asked one of the network admins to search the system accounting records of Netcom, looking for any users who had been logged in at times when the well's accounts were being illicitly accessed by some user at Netcom. The admin searched through the accounting records by matching the logins and logouts that had occurred during the intrusions and was eventually able to track down one of the accounts accessing the well from Netcom's network. It was the G. Kremen account, and it was mostly being used to dial into Netcom through the company's modems in Denver and Raleigh. The next day, when I was searching Markov's email for anything related to me, I ran a search for the string ITNE, since searching for the name Mitnick would have been a dead giveaway. But Shimmy and his team were watching me in real time, and when they saw this search, it confirmed their suspicions that I was their intruder. Shimmy contacted Kent Walker and let him know that the intruder was coming in through dial-up modems in Denver and Raleigh. Shimmy asked Walker to put a trap and trace on the dial-up number to Netcom in Denver that I had been using. This was, again, a very unusual request for a civilian to make of an assistant U.S. attorney. Ordinarily, only law enforcement agencies make such requests. Walker contacted the FBI in Denver, and Denver checked with the Los Angeles FBI office for an okay, but the L.A. office wanted Denver to stay out of it. Instead, in what sounds like an intra-agency turf war, an agent at the L.A. office told the people in Denver they were not to assist with setting up a trap and trace. They all wanted a piece of me. If I'd known about the squabbling at the time, I might have been able to use it to my advantage. As soon as G. Kremen logged on from Raleigh, Shimmy's team asked an FBI agent to contact General Telephone, the telephone company that provisioned Netcom's dial-up numbers in Research Triangle Park, and request that the call be traced in real time. After a couple of attempts, General Telephone's technicians completed a successful trace. They passed on the number to the FBI and advised that it was originating from Sprint's cellular network. But this wasn't information that would lead my pursuers anywhere. To provide an extra layer of protection, I had previously set up what I call a cutout number. The first part of this involved hacking into a phone company switch, finding an unused phone number, and adding call forwarding to the line. Then I set a different billing number in the switch so any calls placed from that number would appear to be originating from the billing number rather than the actual number. Why? I had discovered a flaw in the switch software. It would sometimes report not the actual phone number that a call was originating from, but the billing number. So if phone company techs tried to trace some of my calls, they might not immediately discover my cutout number, the number I was routing my calls through, but instead would come up with a phone number assigned to some random customer I chose. I knew that some switch technicians were not even aware that a trace might report the billing number, which gave me an extraordinary extra level of protection. In any case, in my experience, the phone companies never caught on to my using a cutout number to make it harder to trace where my calls were originating from because it never occurred to them that someone might have hacked into their switch. Several weeks earlier, JSZ had set up an account for me on Escape.com, which was owned by his buddy Ramon Kazan, so the two of us could communicate directly through that system. This had become another of many entry points I used to connect to the internet. Since I had root access, I also stashed numerous hacking tools, exploits, and source code from various companies I had recently been hacking into. My account on Escape.com was named Marty, after the character in the movie Sneakers. Whenever I logged into my account on Escape.com, there was always a notification displaying the date and time of my previous login. The first thing I did each time I logged in was truncate the log entries to eliminate any trace of my comings and goings. But this time when I logged in, I immediately noticed that someone else had logged into my account. From the well. Someone else had been there. What the fuck? I immediately went to the well and started poking around, but didn't find anything that led me to the mystery spy. I disconnected immediately, feeling like I was being watched. Meanwhile, a Sprint engineer was trying to make sense of the number that GTE had traced as originating from the Sprint network. When he searched through the company's customer records, the number didn't come up, which seemed strange. But then the engineer realized it wasn't a Sprint number at all. In fact, it didn't even have a cellular prefix. Shimmy asked the FBI to set up a conference call so he could discuss this oddity with the engineer at Sprint. Then he decided to try calling the number himself to see if anyone would answer. As soon as the call connected, he began to hear a kerchunking noise that would get quieter and quieter until the call was dropped. This was intriguing to him and the engineers. It appeared that I had set up a failsafe to prevent them from tracing me back, and they wondered if I could have tampered with the switch. My using Sprint's cellular network to dial into Netcom through my cutout number made it look as if the cutout number was originating from Sprint's network, when it really wasn't. This was because both the cutout number and Netcom's dial-up number were in the same switch. The Sprint engineer now decided to change tactics and perform what's known as a terminating number search. Rather than looking for calls placed from the traced number, he looked for any subscriber calls to that number. It didn't take him long to hit pay dirt. His search through the call detail records indicated that the traced number had been called numerous times from a Sprint cell phone, or rather, from the cell number I was using to dial into Netcom, a phone with a Raleigh area code. The technician noticed that the calls were usually being routed through the same cellular phone tower. That meant that the phone on the other end was likely in a fixed location. So they now knew where I was. Raleigh. As soon as the engineer told Shimmy what he had figured out, Shimmy hopped on a plane. Destination, Raleigh. I tried calling and emailing JSZ in Israel several times to rule out the unlikely possibility that he had recently accessed my Escape.com account from the well. On Sunday afternoon, while Shimmy was winging his way to Raleigh, JSZ sent me a message that left me up in the air. Hi. This AM my dad had a serious heart attack and is hospitalized here. I have been at the hospital all the day and probably will be here all day on tomorrow as well. Don't expect me to be on computers during next 3 to 4 days. I hope you understand. Regards, Jonathan. Growing more and more nervous, I immediately logged onto the phone company switch that serviced the dial-up numbers to Netcom through Research Triangle Park, one of the routes I had been using in Raleigh for internet access. It was, in fact, my preferred route because cell phone calls direct to Netcom in Denver and elsewhere were not of good quality for long dial-up sessions. When I examined the Netcom dial-up number in the switch, it indicated that the modem number had a trap and trace activated. I started getting an anxious feeling in the pit of my stomach. Now I was really worried. My pursuers were getting too close. How much had they figured out? I needed to know whether the trap had been in place long enough to capture any of my calls. General Telephone has a network operations center in Texas that handles switch surveillance outside of regular working hours. I call and pretend to be from GTE Security. I ask to be transferred to the person handling the Durham Parkwood switch in Raleigh. A lady comes on the line. Listen, I'm working on a suicide case, I tell her. The phone number is 558-8900. What time did the trap go up? She says she'll find out. I wait.
and wait, and wait some more, meanwhile getting more alarmed. Finally, after about 5 minutes, the call is picked up again, not by the same lady, but by a man. I ask, "Did we get any information yet?" He starts asking a series of questions. What's my callback number? Who do I work for? I've done my homework and feed him appropriate answers. "Have your manager call me," he says. "He won't be in till morning," I say. "I'll leave a message for him to call you." Now I'm extremely suspicious. They've been warned that somebody might call. This has all the earmarks of a national security investigation. Is someone getting close to pinpointing my location? As a precaution, I immediately clone my cell phone to a different cellular phone provider, Cellular One, just in case someone really has been tracking me. As soon as Shimmy arrived in Raleigh, he was picked up by a Sprint technician who drove him to the cell site. At the cell site, the techs had a CellScope 2000 for radio direction finding, the same type of unit that the investigators in Seattle had used to track my location. Technicians at Cellular One had been alerted to watch for any strange activity coming from their network. When I placed a cellular call to Netcom, Cellular One identified a data call in progress and informed the posse. They jumped into a vehicle and started driving around, following clues from the CellScope 2000 to hunt down the origin of my cellular radio signal. Within minutes, Shimmy and the other team members were driving around the Players Club looking for any apartments with their lights still on at this early morning hour. A while later, they got a lucky break. The Sprint technician running the surveillance equipment picked up a conversation. John Markoff, who had just arrived in Raleigh to join the chase, recognized one of the voices. It was the well-known founder of the magazine 2600, the Hacker Quarterly, Eric Corley, though he preferred going by his chosen handle, Emmanuel Goldstein, after a character in the novel 1984. Moments later, above the hiss and static and intermittent reception, they heard the voice on the other end of the conversation. Markoff recognized that one, too. "It's him!" Markoff shouted. "It's Mitnick!" 36. An FBI Valentine. February 14th, Valentine's Day. I wrote up some more resumes and cover letters, then later in the evening started poking around again in the accounts of all the system administrators at the well. I was looking for any evidence that I was being watched or that my stash of software had been discovered. I didn't find anything that set off alarm bells. Feeling like taking a break, at about 9 p.m., I headed for the gym and spent an hour on the Stairmaster, and then another hour lifting weights. After a long, relaxing shower, I went to grab some dinner at a 24-hour restaurant. I was a vegetarian at the time, so the menu wasn't all that appealing to me, but it was the only place open so late. A little after midnight, I rolled into the parking lot at the Players Club. The lights were off in most of the apartments. I was oblivious to the surveillance net the feds had set up while I was out. I logged onto the well to take a look around. As I changed the passwords on several new dormant accounts just for insurance, again I had a creepy feeling that someone had been watching me. I decided to go into partial cleanup mode, but first I wanted to make sure I had created copies of all the files I'd moved to the well. Because I didn't have a safe storage locker other than the systems I had been using over the past several weeks, I decided to copy the files to different dormant accounts on the well. Once those were secured, I would find some other site to move them to. Then I noticed that several of the back doors I'd been using to access various systems had mysteriously disappeared. The feds worked very slowly. Even if a call of mine had been traced, it would usually take them days or weeks to investigate. Someone appeared to be hot on my trail, but I still had plenty of time. Or so I thought. As I was working on moving files around, I had a very, very uncomfortable sensation, a sinking feeling in my stomach that something bad was about to happen. Maybe I was just being paranoid. Who had logged into my escape.com account? Why had traps been placed on Netcom's dial-ups? Had Netcom filed a hacking complaint with the feds? Several different scenarios were running through my mind. An hour later, I was still in a stew. I thought it was a little crazy, but my gut kept telling me something wasn't right. No one knew where I was, but I couldn't overcome the feeling that danger lurked nearby. I had to convince myself that there was nothing to it, that I was just
letting myself get spooked.
My apartment door opened onto an outside corridor that gave a good view of the parking lot. I walked to the door, opened it, and scanned the lot. Nothing. Just my imagination. I closed the door and went back to my computer. That peek out the door would prove to be my undoing. The feds had tracked my cell phone signals to the Players Club apartments earlier in the evening, but had apparently concluded, incorrectly, that the signals were coming from an apartment on the other side of the building. When I returned to the complex after dinner, I drove into the Players Club parking lot and walked from my car right through the FBI's surveillance net. But when I poked my head out the door, a deputy U.S. Marshal caught a glimpse of me and thought it was suspicious that so late at night someone would look out of an apartment, peer around, and then vanish inside again. 30 minutes later, at around 1:30, I hear a knock on my door. Without realizing how late it is, I automatically yell, "Who is it?"
"FBI."
I freeze. Another knock. I call out,
"Who are you looking for?"
"Kevin Mitnick. Are you Kevin Mitnick?"
"No,"
I call back, trying to sound annoyed. "Go check the mailboxes." It gets quiet. I begin to wonder if they really have sent someone to check the mailboxes. Do they think I'd have a Mitnick label on the little door of my box? Not good. Obviously, I've underestimated how long it would take the feds to pinpoint my location. I look for an escape route. I go out on my balcony and don't see anyone outside covering the back of the building. I look around inside for something that can serve as a makeshift rope. Bed sheets? No, it'd take too long to tie them into a rope. And besides, what if one of the agents actually tried to shoot me as I was climbing down? More knocking. I phone my mom at home. No time for our go-to-a-casino arrangement. "I'm in Raleigh, North Carolina," I tell her. "The FBI is outside the door. I don't know where they'll take me." We talk for a few minutes, each of us trying to reassure the other. She's beside herself, really upset, distraught, knowing I'm headed back to jail. I tell her I love her and Graham and to be strong, that eventually one day this whole thing will be behind us. At the same time we're on the phone, I'm bustling around the small apartment trying to get out of sight anything that could be a problem. I shut down and unplug my computer. No time to wipe the hard drive. And the laptop is still warm from being used. I hide one cell phone under the bed, the other in my gym bag. Mom tells me to call Aunt Chicky and find out what she recommends. Chicky gives me the home phone number of John Izurdiaga, the attorney I've been working with since the Calabasas search. Now the knocking starts again with demands that I open up. I yell, "I'm sleeping. What do you want?" The voice calls back, "We want to ask you a few questions." Trying to sound as indignant as I can manage, I shout, "Come back tomorrow when I'm awake." They're not going to go away. Is there any chance I can convince them I'm not the guy they're looking for? Several minutes later, I call my mom back and tell her, "I'm going to open the door. Stay on the phone with me." I crack the door open. The guy who has been calling to me is maybe in his late 30s. Black with a graying beard. It's the middle of the night. He's wearing a suit. I figure he must really be FBI. In time, I'll learn he's Lavord Burns, the guy in charge of this operation. The door is barely open, but it's enough for him to stick his foot out and block me from slamming it closed. Several others follow, pushing their way into the room.
"Are you Kevin Mitnick?"
"I already told you I'm not."
Another agent, Daniel Glasgow, starts in on me. He's somewhat older, bulky, with graying hair.
"Hang up the phone," he says.
I tell my mom, "I gotta go." Some of the guys have started searching. I ask, "Do you have a search warrant?"
"If you're Kevin Mitnick, we have an arrest warrant," Burns says.
I tell him, "I want to call my attorney." The agents make no move to stop me. I call Izurdiaga. "Hey, John, this is Thomas Case. I'm in Raleigh, North Carolina. The FBI has just showed up at my door. They think I'm some guy named Mitnick, and they're going through my apartment, but they haven't shown me a search warrant. Can you talk to them?"
I pass the phone to the agent standing in my face, Glasgow. He takes the phone and starts demanding to know who's on the other end of the line. I think Izurdiaga doesn't want to identify himself because he knows I'm using a phony name, and that might raise some ethical issues for him. Glasgow passes the phone to Burns. Now I know who's in charge. I can hear Izurdiaga telling him,
"If you show my client a valid warrant, you're good to search."
They finish the call. Everybody is searching the apartment. Burns asks me for ID. I pull out my wallet and show him my G. Thomas Case driver's license. One searcher comes into the room and shows Burns the cell phone he's just found under my bed. Burns, in the meantime, is pawing through my gym bag and finally comes up with the other cell phone. At this point, cell phone time still costs about $1 a minute, so the fact that I own two phones can't help but raise suspicions. Burns asks me for my cell phone number. I say nothing. I'm hoping he'll turn the phone on. It's a trap I've set in case something like this ever happened. Unless you enter a secret code within 60 seconds of powering up, all of the phone's memory, including the programmed mobile number and ESN, will be erased. Poof. There goes the evidence. Damn, he just hands it off to another agent without powering it up. Again, I demand, where's your search warrant? Burns reaches into a folder and hands me a paper. I look at it and say, this isn't a valid warrant. There's no address. From my reading of law books, I know that the United States Constitution forbids general searches. A warrant is valid only if it is specific and precise about the address to be searched. They go back to searching. Like an actor, I put myself in the mindset of someone being violated. I get loud. You don't have any right to be here. Get out of my apartment. You don't have a search warrant. Get out of my apartment now. A few agents form a circle around me. One of the agents shoves a sheet of paper at me. He says, doesn't this look like you? I can't help smiling to myself. The U.S. Marshals Service has put out a wanted poster on me. Unbelievable. It says, wanted for violation of supervised release. But the picture on it is the one taken more than 6 years ago at the FBI offices in Los Angeles, the same one the New York Times used from back when I was way heavier and grubby-looking from not having showered or shaved for 3 days. I tell the agent, that doesn't look like me at all. Running through my mind is the thought, they're not sure. Maybe I really can get out of this. Burns leaves the apartment. Two guys go back to searching. The other pair stand around watching. When I ask, one of them tells me they're locals from the Raleigh-Durham Fugitive Task Force. What, the feds thought three of their own weren't enough to take down one nonviolent hacker? Agent Glasgow has glommed onto my briefcase. It's filled with papers documenting all my different identities, blank birth certificates and the like, a one-way ticket to prison. He puts it down on the little dining table and opens it. I shout, hey, and the instant he looks up, I slam the cover shut, flip the latch down, and press, spinning the combination wheels and locking the case. He shouts at me, you better open that. I pay no attention. He steps into the kitchen, pulls open some drawers, finds a big carving knife, and comes back in with it. His face has turned a dark shade of red. He goes to stab the knife into the briefcase to cut it open. Another agent, Lethel Thomas, grabs his arm. Everyone else in the room knows that if Glasgow had cut open the briefcase in the absence of a valid search warrant, anything found inside might be ruled inadmissible. Agent Burns has been gone for half an hour. Now he comes back and hands me a different warrant, all typed out and signed by a federal judge, but with my address written in by hand. By now, the other two agents have already been searching, illegally, for more than 2 hours. Agent Thomas starts to search my closet. I try to shout him away, but he ignores me and opens the door. After a while, he turns around, holding up a wallet. Well, well, what do we have here? He says with a distinctly southern drawl. He starts pulling out driver's licenses in all the earlier names I've used. The others stop what they're doing to look. Who's Eric Weiss? He says. Who's Michael Stanfill? I want to grab everything out of his hands, but I'm afraid it might look as if I were attacking him. Not a good idea in a room full of guys with pistols. Now they know I'm not just a clean, hard-working citizen, but they've come to arrest Kevin Mitnick, and there's nothing in the wallet that will help them pin that on me. Evidently, I've been playing my part so convincingly, the private citizen I rate at being unfairly harassed, that they're now discussing whether they should take me downtown and fingerprint me to prove I really am Mitnick and just trying to pull a fast one on them. I say, that's a good idea. What time do you want me to be at your office in the morning? They ignore me. Now all three of the feds go back to searching. So far, my luck is still holding out. And then it happens. Thomas is going through all the clothes in my closet. He's searching my old ski jacket. From a zippered inner pocket, he pulls out a piece of paper.
A pay stub, he announces. Made out to Kevin Mitnick.
Agent Thomas shouts, "You're under arrest." Not like on television. No one bothers to read me, my Miranda rights. I've been so careful, and now a pay stub from a company I worked at briefly after leaving Beit Teshuvah, hidden away for years in an overlooked inner pocket of that ski jacket, has been my undoing. I can taste bile in my throat and can't even get to a sink to spit. I tell the agents I need to take my gastric reflux medicine. They look at the label and see that it's been prescribed by a doctor, but they refuse to let me take one. Incredibly, I've held them at bay for 3.5 hours. And I've been hiding in plain sight for nearly 3 years, with the FBI, U.S. Marshals Service, and Secret Service all looking for me. But now, it's over. Agent Thomas glares at me and says, "Mitnick, the jig is up." Rather than handcuffing me behind my back, the deputy U.S. Marshal puts me in cuffs, a belly chain, and leg irons. They walk me out the door. And I know at that moment that I'm not going away for just a short time.
37. Winning the Scapegoat Sweepstakes.
My new home was the Wake County Jail in downtown Raleigh, which offered a decidedly different form of Southern hospitality. As I was being booked, the federal agents gave strict orders again and again and again that I was not to be allowed anywhere near a phone. I asked every uniform going past my cell to let me call my family. They all might as well have been deaf. But one jailer seemed to be a little more sympathetic. I gave her a story about how I needed to call my family to arrange bail. She took pity on me and, after a short while, moved me to a cell with a telephone. My first call was to my mom. Graham had driven over so the two of them could worry about me together. They were both in a highly emotional state, very upset and distraught. How many times had I done this to them, bringing such pain into their lives because their son, grandson, was going back to prison, perhaps for a very long time? After that, I called DePayne. Since all calls from jail cells are monitored, I couldn't say very much.
"Yes, hello," mumbled a sleepy Louis DePayne. It was around 1 o'clock a.m. California time, the morning of February 15, 1995.
"This is a collect call," said the operator. "Caller, what's your name?"
"Kevin."
"Will you accept the charges?"
"Yeah," said DePayne.
"I just was arrested by the FBI tonight. I'm in jail in Raleigh, North Carolina. I just thought you ought to know," I told my co-conspirator. He didn't need me to spell out that he had to go into immediate cleanup mode once again. The next morning, I'm taken to court for my first appearance, still in the black sweats I wore to go to the gym some 12 hours ago. On my last night of freedom. I'm stunned to see that the courtroom is buzzing and packed, with every seat filled. It seems like half the people in there have either a camera or a reporter's pad. It's a media circus. You'd think the feds had caught Manuel Noriega. My gaze settles on a man standing near the front of the courtroom, a man I have never met in person but immediately recognize. Tsutomu Shimomura. The FBI might never have caught me if he hadn't become irate enough about the break-in to his servers to drop everything else and lead the parade to find me. He glares at me. He and his girlfriend are giving me the eagle eye, especially the lady. John Markoff starts scribbling. My hearing lasts only a few minutes, ending with an order from the magistrate that I be held without bail, and once again, that I be held without access to a telephone. I can't stand the thought. I'm headed back to solitary. As I'm being led out in handcuffs, I pass Shimmy. He's one, fair and square. I nod to him and figuratively tip my hat. "I respect your skills," I tell him. Shimmy returns the nod. Coming out of the courthouse in chains, I hear shouts of, "Hey, Kev!" I look up to the balcony where what seems like 100 paparazzi are aiming their cameras at me and now clicking away, flashbulbs going. Oh my God, I think, this is a lot bigger than I thought. I'm beside myself. How did I come to be this much of a story? Of course, I didn't see it when it was published, but Markov's article in the next day's New York Times, even longer than his Independence Day piece of the year before, and once again on the front page, seemed certain to cement the image of Osama bin Mitnick in the public's mind. Markov quoted Kent Walker, the assistant U.S. attorney from San Francisco, as saying, "Mitnick was arguably the most wanted computer hacker in the world. He allegedly had access to trade secrets worth billions of dollars. He was a very big threat." At the time of Markov's original July 4th story, I was wanted only for violation of my supervised release. Yet the story left readers with the impression that I was a supervillain, a threat to every American. His account of my arrest now ignited a fire under the rest of the media. The item was picked up on Dateline, Good Morning America, and God only knows how many other major shows. My capture was all over the news for 3 days straight. Typical of the tone of the coverage was a piece published in the February 27, 1995 issue of Time. The subhead began, "America's Most Wanted Hacker Has Been Arrested." The news from my court-appointed attorney in Raleigh wasn't good. I was indicted on 23 counts of access device fraud. Of these, 21 were related to calls made when my phone was cloned to someone else's number. The other two counts were for possessing information, specifically the mobile phone number and electronic serial number pairs that could be used for cloning. The maximum sentence was 20 years for each free phone call. 20 years for each call. I was facing a worst-case scenario of 460 years. It did look bad for me. 460 years was no walk in the park. I didn't relish the idea of being locked away in prison for the rest of my life, unable to live a happy and productive life, and especially not being able to spend quality time with my mom and grandmother. They had me, hands down, for cloning cell phone numbers. The ESNs were considered unauthorized access devices under federal law. It was also true that I'd violated the terms of my 1989 supervised release by hacking into the voicemail of Pacific Bell security investigator Daryl Santos to gain information on the Teltec case, and also by associating with computer hackers. But 460 years for these evil crimes? Were there no war criminals left? Of course, the feds had also found Netcom's customer database that contained more than 20,000 credit card numbers on my computer, but I had never attempted to use any of them. No prosecutor would ever be able to make a case against me on that score. I have to admit, I had liked the idea that I could use a different credit card every day for the rest of my life without ever running out, but I'd never had any intention of running up charges on them, and never did. That would be wrong. My trophy was a copy of Netcom's customer database. Why is that so hard to understand? Hackers and gamers get it instinctively. Anyone who loves to play chess knows that it's enough to defeat your opponent. You don't have to loot his kingdom or seize his assets to make it worthwhile. It always seemed strange to me that my captors had such trouble grasping the deep satisfaction that could be derived from a game of skill. Sometimes I couldn't help but wonder if maybe my motives seemed incomprehensible to them because they themselves would have found the temptation of all those credit cards impossible to resist. Even Markov, in his New York Times article, admitted that I was clearly not interested in the prospect of financial gain. The scale of what I'd passed up was brought home to readers by Kent Walker's assertion that I allegedly had access to corporate trade secrets worth billions of dollars. But since I was never going to use or sell that information, what it was worth didn't matter to me. So what was the nature of my crime, that I'd allegedly had access? Now that I've finally been caught, prosecutors in several federal jurisdictions were frantically compiling long wish lists of counts and accusations against me. But I still had reason for hope. Despite the evidence, the government's case was not airtight. There were legal conflicts that had to be resolved first. Shimmy, for instance, had been secretly working as a de facto government agent and was intercepting my communications without a warrant, which smacked of gross government misconduct. My attorney had also filed a motion claiming that the government's search warrant was flawed. If the court ruled in my favor, all the evidence seized in North Carolina would be inadmissible, not only in Raleigh, but everywhere else. To John Bowler, the young up-and-coming assistant U.S. attorney assigned to my case, this must have seemed like a golden opportunity. If he could get convictions on all counts and convince the judge to slap me with a massive punitive sentence, the media attention alone would be enough to launch his career. But the reality was that federal sentencing guidelines would ordinarily require the judge to base my sentence on the minimal losses to the cell phone companies when I made those free phone calls. After my first court appearance, when I was transported to the Johnston County Jail in Smithfield, North Carolina, the U.S. Marshals ordered my jailers to put me in the one place I feared most. The hole. I couldn't believe it was happening. Shuffling toward that door in leg irons and shackles, I resisted every step. Time itself seemed to slow down. I knew then that the main thing that had kept me on the run for the past 3 years was my fear of this place. I didn't think I could take being in there again. Now here the guards were leading me right back into my nightmare, and there was nothing I could do to stop them. The last time, in 1988, they'd put me in solitary confinement for more than 8 months to get me to do what they wanted. As soon as I signed their plea agreement, they put me in with the general population. And this time, the government wasn't shoving me into this hellhole to protect the public from me or me from other inmates. It was coercion, pure and simple. The message was clear. All I had to do was agree to the prosecutor's demands and waive certain rights and agree to only call my immediate family and legal counsel, and they'd be more than happy to let me out of solitary into the general population. I wish I could describe the sinking feeling I had as I stepped inside. After living in dread of the hole for so many years, it took everything I had not to totally lose it when they locked the door behind me. I would rather have shared a cell with a tattooed, whacked-out drug dealer than find myself locked up alone like this again. The rap about computer geeks is that we spend countless hours in small, dark rooms, crouched over the glowing screens of our laptops, not even knowing whether it's day or night. To a 9-to-5-er, that might seem like solitary, but it's not. There's a huge difference between spending time alone and being thrown into a disgusting, dirty coffin that is your home today, tomorrow, next month, with no light at the end of the tunnel, controlled by people who are doing their best to make you miserable. No matter how hard you try to reframe it in your head, being in the hole is grim and depressing 24/7. Solitary confinement is widely condemned as torture. Even now, the United Nations is working to have its use declared inhumane. Many experts say that extended solitary confinement is far worse than waterboarding or other forms of physical torture. In the hole, prisoners commonly suffer from lethargy, despair, rage, and severe depression, and other forms of mental illness. The isolation, idleness, and lack of structure can easily start to unravel your mind. Without anyone else to interact with, you have no way to rein in your thoughts or keep your perspective. It's far more of a nightmare than you can even imagine. That's why every study of solitary confinement of more than 60 days has shown damaging psychological effects. Sometimes they're permanent. I was afraid of that. It had been over 6 years since I had been in solitary, and it still haunted me. I wanted to get out of there as fast as I could. A week after I was thrown into solitary, the federal prosecutors offered a deal to move me into the general population if I would waive my rights and agree to no bail hearing, no preliminary hearing, no phone calls except to my legal counsel and a few family members. Sign the agreement, they said, and I could get out of solitary. I signed. My Los Angeles attorney, John Izurdiaga, and his partner, Richard Steingard, helped me make the deal. Since I had been arrested in Raleigh, both attorneys graciously donated their time to work on my case. John had volunteered to represent me pro bono ever since the time in late 1992 when FBI agents searched my Calabasas apartment. Once I was back in the general population of the prison, I spoke to John Izurdiaga and Richard Steingard over the phone. There was a tension in John's voice I'd never heard before. To my surprise, both men started grilling me about state secrets. "Exactly what kind of confidential information did you have access to?
Have you hacked into any U.S. intelligence agencies?
When I understood what they were getting at, I laughed out loud.
Right, like I'm a spy engaged in some sort of secret espionage, I said.
Neither one of them laughed.